For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and in today's show, Robert and I get out and about at book festivals.
Over the past few years, we've been lucky enough to get out of the studio to festivals such as iWrite, Boswell, and the Wigtown Book Festival.
So sit back and relax as we bring you some of our favourite festival highlights.
First up in our festival adventure, Red caught up with Alexander McCall Smith to hear about his writing and some very bad music.
Alexander McCall Smith, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
You were talking about the importance of W.H. Auden in your life and why he should be part of our lives. Would you tell the listeners why?
Well, Auden was a wonderful poet. I think there was a marvellous, humane voice there. The range of his work is extraordinary. He deals with all sorts of topics. So there's a poet who can make a great poem out of limestone. His famous poem In Praise of Limestone shows that a great poet can address something as I was about to say, as concrete as limestone, but as basic as limestone. And he's an interesting poet, an amusing poet, but I think just a very moving poet who tells us a lot about how we can go through our lives. And that's what my little book on Auden is about, really, on how Auden's insights can help us in our own lives.
He wasn't a poet who was taught when I was at school in the 80s. Do you think he's due a bit of a resurgence?
Yes, I'm always very keen that more people should discover Auden. He had a bit of a resurgence when one of his poems was used in a very popular film, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and that resulted in a spike of interest in Auden. I would hope that people who haven't read his poetry will consider exploring it. I think that he hasn't dated in a way in which some poets may, or writers in general. Auden is as fresh, I think, today as he was when he first published those poems. It's as fresh. So, yes, I hope that there's a renewed interest in him. He still has a pretty big public. He's probably not read in schools very much, or as much as he might be, I suppose, because he's thought to be unsuitable for school use, so to speak. The poems are very, and some of them are very intellectually challenging, although I'm sure that at the upper end of the school, people would be able to understand and appreciate Auden.
Do you write poetry yourself?
Yes, I do. I've written quite a bit, and some of it is published in my Scotland Street books. At the end of every Scotland Street book, I have Angus Lordy, one of the characters, comes up with a poem, which actually is written by me, but I attribute it to Angus. So I do that, and I write. I've written quite a lot for composers recently, song cycles in which I've written poems which they've set to music. So yes, I do quite a bit.
Now, my daughter, who's a bassoonist, tells me that you're a budding bassoonist as well and playing a rather special orchestra.
Well, yes, I do play the bassoon. It's some time since I played the bassoon, because I've taken recently in our little amateur orchestra, I've taken to playing the baritone sax rather than the bassoon. I was never very good as a bassoonist. And I'm not very good as a saxophonist either. In fact, I'm a really bad musician. But our orchestra is called the Really Terrible Orchestra, and what you see on the tin is what you get. We are musically challenged people who play awfully, and the result can be pretty dreadful. But we get great pleasure in doing it, and we actually get people coming to our concerts, which is extraordinary. So it's great fun. Making music with other people is one of life's great delights, I think, to do that.
Do you think it's a good counterpoint to the rather solitary life of a writer?
I think that's right. I think that I certainly find when I play with the orchestra. I enjoy the society of the other musicians, or would-be musicians, really. So, yes, it is. I know writing can be a lonely activity. As you say, you're sitting there and you're doing the writing by yourself. There's nobody to help you do it. So I think that it's nice to be able to work with other people. That's one of the reasons why I quite like writing for composers, because that's a collaborative enterprise and you're working together with somebody.
Not all your writing is done in your own time frame, is it? I know that the Scotland Street novels are written to be serialised in the newspaper. Does that put an additional strain on you when you are writing them? You can't go back and edit them.
Yes, that's a very interesting point, and that is one problem with publishing those novels in that way, in that with my Scotland Street series, they are a proper serial novel of the sort that used to be done in the 19th century. So Dickens, as everybody knows, did that, but other writers did it. Flaubert, Trollope did it. Yes, it was a fairly standard way of publishing. But as you say, one of the concomitants of that is that you... it's already published, and so if, for example, you want to get rid of a character, normally, as an author, one would just be able to edit the completed manuscript and remove the character, but you can't do that in a serial novel. So things have happened in the serial novel that you're just going to have to live with. So if you, for example, introduce characters and you get fed up with them, one of the other characters will say, "Where's so-and-so? Gone, disappeared," which, of course, is like life.
You've never killed anybody off and then thought, "Oh, I wish I hadn't done that."
I have. I think probably an awful lot of writers of fiction have done that at some stage, and I did it with one of my characters in the Scotland Street book. There was a wonderful man called Lard O'Connor, and Lard O'Connor was a sort of Glasgow gangster, really, not to put too fine a point on it. And I had Lard O'Connor comes over to Edinburgh and has a heart attack and falls down some steps, and that's him out of the book. And I actually wanted, the reason why I did that was that I had seen a photograph in the Scotsman newspaper of the funeral of a very well-known Glasgow gangster who was called the Licensee. And they had his funeral, and you should have seen the pictures of the mourners with scars on their faces and whatnot. And so I disposed of Lard O'Connor and then regretted it, but it was too late. I couldn't bring him back.
Your books translate very well, exceptionally well, into audiobooks and talking books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Do you go to some pains to select the right narrators for them?
I don't do the actual selection. What they do with me, and which I think probably do with most writers, is that they'll say, "We're proposing to use so-and-so, is that okay with you?" And I usually say, "That's fine." Sometimes I'm asked to choose between two or three, and there I will say, "Well, I prefer that voice to this voice," or something of that sort. But generally speaking, they're very good, and I think they do a very good job of it. I stand in admiration of them, because it's quite a task. Reading a whole book for a recording, you've got to keep your voice up. You've got to make sure that it doesn't, you know, your voice doesn't slow down, that you drop into a different register, and it's quite a business. I did one of my own children's books, or two of them, I think, for audio version from my American audio publishers, and those weren't very long, but my goodness me, it was an education for me to see just what was entailed in reading a book for those purposes. It's quite an art, I think.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do. I very much enjoy listening to audiobooks. I download them from the relevant site, and I like them. Although there is a problem with audio, I find a problem with audiobooks in that if I listen to them at night, I will maybe sort of listen to them in bed when I go to bed. And the problem with that, of course, is, you know, one drops off to sleep and then you wake up and you're sort of three chapters. So there are various books that I've gone back to time and time again, trying to remember where I went to sleep.
And picking up from there.
Yes, I spend quite a lot of time sort of going back in chapters looking for where I was. Inevitably you fall asleep at the end of a chapter, don't you?
Indeed.
And have to listen to the whole thing all over again.
My iPad has the sleep timer, so I can say 45 minutes, which means I don't miss too many chapters if I...
And finally, what are you working on at the moment? What are you writing at the moment?
I find myself writing more than one book at the same time. So I'm writing volume 19 of the Number One Ladies Detective Agency, and that book is going to be called The Colours of All the Cattle. So I'm going to finish that by the end of this current month. And I'm also writing another book, which I'll finish, I think, next week, called Mr. Varg, about a Swedish detective I've invented called Ulf Varg. And so it's a tribute to Scandinavian noir, but I'm calling it Scandinavian Blanc, and I'm having great fun doing that. So, I've got three books on the go, come to think of it. I've got another novel which I've written the first three chapters of, which I'm going to have to devote myself to once I've put the latest Mara Motswe book to bed. And that's called The Second Worst Restaurant in France. And, I'm looking forward to spending more time with that book.
Alexander McCall-Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to a special Read On, bringing you some of the best reports from book festivals around the country. We've been lucky enough the past few years to get to the Wigtown Book Festival.
Much of the festival centres around The Bookshop, owned by Sean Biffle. Sean's partner at The Bookshop for several years was Jessica Fox, herself a published author. In an office above the shop, she told me her unique story.
The book is a memoir, and it begins with when I worked for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory right near Pasadena, California, and I began having visions of working in a bookshop by the sea in Scotland. And at the time, I was working for NASA in the daytime, and then I'd be making my films in the nighttime, so I thought, oh, maybe this is a nice rom-com that I'm going to write. So I sat down to write it, and I started getting more irritated that all the characters that I was writing about were having amazing adventures, and here I was in the heat of Los Angeles sitting in one room just staring at a screen. So I thought, you know what, this is an adventure I want to have. And the more I sort of delved into the vision of it, the more I could see myself behind the long wooden counter, and I could see that outside it was raining, and I could just feel it was Scotland, and I was surrounded by books, and I was in a big woolly jumper drinking tea and just very content. So I go on to type in used bookshop into Google, and Wigtown comes up, and Wigtown's Scotland's national book town. And it said it had 16 bookshops and about 900 people right by the sea. And there is a hubris to dreaming, because this vision was so strong, I thought one of them is going to take me in as a live-work holiday. So I type in, the first bookshop on the list was called The Bookshop. So I type an email out, and I try to sound as normal as possible, and I don't talk about the vision at all. And then within three correspondences, I had booked my ticket, and I was coming over to Scotland. And I had assumed that the bookshop owner was sort of elderly and in his probably 80s and surrounded by grandchildren who were helping him with these emails, because his emails were quite short and sweet. But when I got there, I realized the bookshop owner was kind of a disheveled, very charming, very smart, and really lovely man who was much younger than 80. And I ended up falling in love with the town and him and staying. So that's sort of what the book is about and the adventures that ensued.
That's a wonderful story. What did your friends and family say?
Speechless may have been. My mum, when I first came over, just for kind of the holiday, she looked at me quite sternly and said, don't fall in love with anyone. So she must have also had a premonition that that would have happened. I think people were quite shocked, but they also, the more we started chatting about it with my friends, the more I realized that they kind of harbored dreams. One wanted to work in a flower shop in Amsterdam. There were all these parallel lives that kind of people were fantasizing about but not acting on. It led to some really interesting conversations.
And you're still here, which means that the love affair with the Scottish book town has still continued.
Yet the love affair with the Scottish book town has continued. Unfortunately, the bookshop owner and I lasted a very long time, but didn't work out. We're still very, very good friends. But what it did was definitely reorient my ship towards Scotland and staying here. And I absolutely love living in the UK. I love making films here. I love writing here. And my relationship with Wigtown has continued and deepened. So it's been lovely.
And is there going to be a film of three things you know need to know about rockets?
Do you know, there may be. So Sean has just written a book, Diary of a Bookseller, and we're actually combining our books because he talks about the day-to-day life of running a bookshop. I have kind of the very American romantic vision of falling in love with a Scotsman in the sea and have more of a narrative. So we're actually combining our books and working with a producer to maybe hopefully make a TV show.
And for visually impaired audience members, is there an audiobook?
There isn't an audiobook, and I'd absolutely love if there was one. So if anyone who's a good reader wants to volunteer, I will happily work with them. I'm a bit dyslexic, so it's very hard for me to read my own work aloud. So I would absolutely love teaming up with someone who would want to do an audiobook for me.
Now, I also happen to know that another thing that you and Sean worked on together was destructive testing of Kindles. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, trying to channel Sean's rage at the, and the Kindles. Sure. You know, it was really began with Sean's... We were watching a lot of YouTube videos. We started a company called Picto Productions, where we'd make a lot of films in the area. Sean had an interest in documentary a while back before starting the bookshop, and I was a filmmaker. So together, it's just sort of we made lots of fun videos about the shop, and it was Sean's idea to shoot a Kindle. I think he just really wanted to. So we started thinking about ways to destroy Kindles, and that was quite good fun.
And obviously, being a filmmaker, you must have to consider those people who might not be able to see the film. Have you worked with audio description at all?
You know, we have. I've worked with audio description in the past when I worked with NASA because we made different videos for them. And the sound design, there is a... I'd like to shout out to one of my favorite artists who's a storyteller. So when I was working at NASA, instead of videos, we decided to hire a man named Jay O'Callaghan, who's one of the last remaining oral storytellers. And he is very visual, but he describes the images that he sees. And so he lived within NASA for about a year and created a story for NASA that is all audio. So I have a real passion and interest for storytelling, and it tends usually not to be on the screen.
And I know that there's quite a bit of research going into the audio version of virtual reality being done at NASA as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think for a scientific organization, I would really love to tell people that it is probably one of the most creative powerhouses near Los Angeles, and that includes the film industry. I think NASA is on the cutting edge of entertainment and inclusion, and also figuring out really innovative solutions to a lot of problems, not just in science.
Jessica Fox, thank you so much for joining us on Read On Air.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB newsagent service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, and I remember that that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation. One of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny, it was a joy to read. Studio B was the Snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B. I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the RNIB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to a special Read On, bringing you some of our festival highlights from over the years. And here's a rocking favourite from Robert.
Mark Ellen is a magazine editor, journalist and broadcaster who's recently released his book, Rock Stars Stole My Life. You may remember him from presenting the BBC's Whistle Test from 82 to 87 and co-presenting the Live Aid TV broadcast in 1985. I spoke to him at I Write, Glasgow's book festival.
My name is Mark Ellen, and the book I've written is called Rock Stars Stole My Life, which has an exclamation mark at the end. Will and I were 17 and ecstatic just to be away from our home turf of Fleet, Hampshire, a town of such skull-cracking tedium that you spend every waking hour plotting an escape from the place. There were two types of people in life, Will reckoned. You were either Dewey or non-Dewey, and we were Dewey. We did stuff.
It's a personal memoir, but I'm not a celebrity, so it's you don't find out the tragic day when I failed my 11 plus or lost my virginity in chapter 3, or actually probably in real life it would have been chapter 17. But I'm just your guide across the colourful landscape of pop and rock music. So it's a book about music, but it's a book about my personal, and it's about my relationship with music. So I suppose the first third of it or so, it's just about universal moments, really. It's about just falling in love with pop stars and buying tickets to concerts and putting posters up on the wall and watching people on stage in clouds of dry ice and orange lighting. And then through the career that I was lucky enough to get, starting out at the Record Mirror when I was in my early 20s, and then I went on to the New Musical Express and Smash Hits and various magazines like Q and Mojo and The Word. And also I had a kind of tangential side career in Radio 1 and presenting the Old Grey Whistle Test. And so I met a load of musicians. And it's about the evolution of music over those 50 years. It starts with the first Beatles single coming out in 1962, rattling down the spindle of a Dansette machine when I was 8. And it ends, actually, on a private jet with Rihanna flying around the world. And it looks at, what became firstly of music and how music changed. It looks at how my relationship with music changed as I got older, and it had different values and, all the interesting and daft and fascinating things that was the soundtrack to what made me think and feel and do. But also it's the history of those media too. It's in a way it's looking at the great boom in magazines that I was lucky enough to work for. And in television. In fact, the high point of the television bit was where I present Live Aid. In 1985, I'm one of the television presenters of Live Aid, and what an utter chaos that was, and what a lot of fun. So that's broadly it.
It sort of seems to encapsulate the period of time when musicians got paid for selling music rather than doing concerts. Do you think that's changed music, the fact that it's easily and readily available for free?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, actually, you've completely nailed the whole business model of the rock music industry and turned it on its head, because when I was a kid, concerts were quite cheap. You know, you went to see the Ramones or the Pretenders or whoever, or David Bowie. It was quite cheap to get in. But the reason they were doing it was they were hoping that everybody went to the concert might buy the album. Mm. Albums were quite expensive. Of course, that's now reversed. You know, you can't sell records because of the digital explosion. You can only give them away. And so what they do is they give away their records to anybody who wants them, in the hope that enough people might want to pay a large amount of money to go and see them play the Hammersmith Apollo. You know, so that's, yeah, it's completely different, really. And there are lots of different factors to that. I mean, it was a brilliant time when people could make music and it was an artistic statement, and it was done in the forge in the heat of a moment, and those beautiful sleeves. I mean, a lot of the books about vinyl, and about the formats, the format changes, and vinyl, and cassettes, and CDs, and eventually the iCloud. And those things affect your relationship with music too, I think. Mm.
Now, you mentioned vinyl. How do you think the technology has changed? And I'm going way back to the history of recorded sound.
Well, I think one of the most fascinating things about recorded sound is that if you look back to, I suppose, what, would it be 150 years ago? Maybe not even that much. If you heard music, if you could hear music, by definition, somebody was playing it within earshot. I think that's really exciting, actually. I remember when John Peel, the fabulous Radio 1 and Radio 4 presenter, when he died, Paul Gambaccini made a speech at his funeral, which I was at the cathedral in Suffolk. And he made the point that John Peel had heard more recorded music than anybody else who'd ever lived, because John Peel had arrived at the point when the largest diversity of recorded music was available, and John Peel made a point of every day listening to as much of the stuff as he possibly could in order to audition people to be on his radio program. I thought that was a really interesting point about Peel, that the sheer encyclopedic knowledge, experience that he had of music from all over the world was second to none. There's nobody like him. I don't know, those technologies have changed, and I think your the formats have really changed our relationship. You know, when you could go off and buy music and on vinyl, and it was it was expensive and it was hard to come by. I think being kind of underserved and really appreciating it made you really appreciate the music more. I mean, Elvis Costello, who's exactly the same age as me, actually, he and I both bought Joni Mitchell's Blue when it came out, her absolute masterpiece record, which was in about, I don't know, 70, 71. And we both had little portable record players and would listen to it at night. And you know, the thing would click off at the end of side one, and that would wake you up if you'd gone to sleep. You'd turn on, put on side two, and you'd just have all night just turning on this record, listening to it over again, till you wore it out. And he said, we wore out the grooves because we listened to it so intently and with such passion and such involvement. And I think a lot of that was to do with the fact that it was hard to come by, it was expensive. I didn't just pull it down from an iCloud and on a phone and click it away again. So I think that made life easier, actually, for us.
Do you think the journey of listening to an album then has been lost? You're not listening to track one to ten with a break in the middle to turn it over. You are downloading individual tracks.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. And I think that's quite a crucial part of it, because actually, to answer that question, if you listen to whole albums in their entirety, that's where you stumbled across the extraordinary idiosyncrasies and weird little B-sides and odd little outtakes and moments of utter brilliance. The Beatles had loads of them. There's a song by the Beatles called Hey Bulldog. And anybody listening could maybe find that on the internet and listen to it. And it's just extraordinary. Nobody really knows it. It's just as magnificent as anything else they ever did. And they did it in about two takes while waiting for the crew to set up to record a video for Lady Madonna. And, I think people would have missed that if they hadn't listened to that whole album all the way through. So that is that's a big part of it, I think.
We'd formed a blues band with a four-song set performed in the weather-beaten drawl of our stage characters Ramblin' Will Thompson and Mississippi Mark Ellen, pretending we were from the deep south rather than a leafy suburb just outside of Farnborough, where practically everybody owned a lawnmower. Will was blonde, stubbly, had a suede jacket, and looked annoyingly like Robert Redford. I had an army greatcoat and some maroon cord trousers. Our matted hair was full of burrs as we'd slept in a thistle patch near Colchester. We looked tremendous, we reckoned, wind-battered travellers on the road to discovery.
Now, from one extreme to another in our festival highlight show, we've gone from groupies to husband hunters. Here's Red at the Wigtown Book Festival talking to Anne de Courcy.
You're listening to Read On Air, recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Now, it's time to go husband hunting with Anne de Courcy. She talked to Red Sale.
And of course, welcome to Read On Air.
Hello, Red. It's very nice to be with you. My book came out 2 or 3 months ago. Its subtitle does quite a lot of explaining what it's about. It's The Husband Hunters, Social Climbing in London and New York.
It's a subject I knew a little bit about because I've always rather liked Evelyn Waugh novels, and American heiresses on the hunt for a broke baronet seem to pop up quite a lot there. Were there many of them coming over to England?
My book is actually set between 1870 and, I suppose, 1905, when a huge influx of American girls, about 100, married into the peerage. It was a kind of almost like a gold rush. Well, the gold was on their side. They brought it over. But an awful lot of them came over, and the real reason was because very often they were made to by their mothers, who were the real husband hunters, because their mothers wanted to get into New York society. And you couldn't get into New York society if you didn't know Mrs. Astor. And if Mrs. Astor didn't want to know you, she didn't know you. But she would never refuse to know the mother-in-law of a duke.
Oh, so it really was as acquisitive as that to get into the right salon.
It was absolutely like that. I mean, post-American Civil War, enormous fortunes were made in America because the South had to be reconstructed, railways had to be reconstructed, iron, metal, army supplied, all kinds of things. So there were a whole lot of hugely rich men, and they were married to women who were equally competitive, I suppose, but their only battlefield was the drawing room, the salon, and they wanted to get into New York society. And they fought and fought to do so, but they were regarded by old New York as very nouveau. They were called the bouncers, some of them. And very often their daughters were their weapons. If you had a beautiful daughter, she could marry up, as they say. And sometimes she married into an old American family, in which case you were all right. But other times she had to go farther afield, and that's what started the rush to Europe. And then after the Franco-German War, first they went to France, where they were welcomed at the court of the Empress Eugenie. As long as you were rich, beautiful, and beautifully dressed, you were very welcome there. But after the Franco-German War, they had to look further afield, and they managed to get an entree into England. And quite a bit of that was due to the Prince of Wales, who loved American women, as did a lot of people, because they had very special qualities.
And so they were welcome. Were many of the marriages successful?
Somewhere, the marriages that were successful were there were one or two that were actually for love, like Jenny Churchill and Lord Randolph Churchill, who proposed to her 3 days after he saw her. And they married. There was great opposition from both families at first, but they managed to marry. But an awful lot were not happy, because there you were, a beautiful, rich, young, fated American girl in your own country. And to leave your family, your friends, everybody you knew, to come over to a country that had fairly cold and damp, that hadn't heard of central heating, the plumbing was rather shaky, to say the least, and to live in a society with a husband who took over all your money, it all went straight into his pocket, and where you were treated, unlike in America, you were very much treated as the subsidiary, the second-class citizen. They were not used to that. They were no longer princesses. They were adjuncts. And it didn't always go down very well.
And I suppose a lot of them were living in rather tumble-down ancestral homes that needed a lot of money, or a lot of their money, to put right, which can't have been particularly luxurious for them.
Well, that's perfectly true. I mean, Consuelo Vanderbilt, when she married the Duke of Marlborough, the Marlboroughs were on the pitch on the edge of being really broke. And even during the honeymoon, he was spending the enormous dowry she had brought with her. Well, I mean, the results you can see in Blenheim today, it's wonderful. But their dowries went straight into these places. And it's true, they kept a lot of these places absolutely going. Some of them, let's face it, took to it like a duck to water. May Galette, who married the Duke of Roxburgh, she was older, she knew her own mind, she was 25 as opposed to 20, so she'd seen quite a lot of the world. And she had made up her mind that really, with her looks and her money, nothing but a duke would do, but he would have to be a rather special duke. And the Duke of Roxburgh was very good-looking, very nice, had a wonderful place. She married him and was very happy. There were so many of them, there were actually advertisements in the papers from indigent peers or baronets seeking ladies with a fortune of no less than whatever it is. I will treat you in all respects properly. I will never disclose what happened, but the fortune must be whatever. You know, and one enterprising American journalist pretended she was an heiress and came over and put advertisements in the paper, and she got a flock of replies. And to her great surprise, when she actually went to interviewed some of these people, she said they were exactly what they said they were. But she didn't take any of them up. She wrote it up for her paper, but it was, you know, you would see advertisements in the Daily Telegraph for an American heiress.
I'm struck by the similarities in some ways to another one of your books, The Fishing Fleet, which describes how young women were sent out from Britain to India from the 1830s onward.
They really started actually from, I think, the early 1600s. It was a 300-year spell, and the first lot were sent out. This was the fishing fleet. The first lot were actually sent out because the East India Company, it was voyages then, took about 6 months and no real certainty you'd get there. They were terrible voyages, so that they didn't come back on leave. Men didn't come back on leave. And a lot of them married or had liaison with Indian women, but quite a lot wanted a British bride. And sometimes orphans of good family who'd got no money and no prospects in England would be sent out there. These girls were sent out, the early ones, and they were fed and clothed by the East India Company for a year. And during that year, the pretty ones, the nice ones, they were snapped up incredibly quickly. I mean, one who was widowed when her husband got cholera was actually proposed to as she came out of the funeral. They really were snapped up. But the ones who were too nasty or too plain or too awful even to find husbands in the depths of the province, were sent back at the end of the year, and they were called returned empties, which is not very nice.
Very sad.
Yes.
And I know from talking to you last night that your new book is really quite exciting. It's The Life and Times of Coco Chanel.
Yes, it's going to be called Chanel's Riviera, and it's about the years 1930 to 1944. In 1930, Chanel put down roots on the Riviera in the shape of her first and only house. It was a sanctuary. It was called La Pausa, and she went there every year. You see, from 1934 onwards, she lived in the Ritz. She lived in an hotel. So it was her only real home. And the Riviera during the 30s, it was incredibly glamorous at first. And then, of course, all these shadows from the coming war. And then you get from June 1940, when the armistice was signed between France and Germany, then you get this terrible oppression of the Jews by Vichy France. And so I've been researching the stories of some of the ones who, they came to the Riviera because they thought it would be safe, you see. And they came into these terrible difficulties. They weren't even allowed to earn a living. So I've been researching some of their stories. So you have the glitter, first of all, and then you have the very dark shadows, and then comes the liberation.
And she, of course, was a woman who came from nothing, died very rich, very successful, but again used her beguiling looks and personality to forward her ambition.
Absolutely, and her talent. I mean, that was the great thing. She had this genius, really. I mean, she was an innovator. She produced quite different clothes from before. That's what put her on the map. As opposed to the flounces, the frills, the endless goffering and pleating and ironing and ribbons and frills. She produced simple clothes that women could move in. They could, if need be, in a Chanel suit, you can run for a bus quite happily. You could never have done it before. Sort of starkly elegant, but she softened those with wonderful ropes of beads, precious stones, semi-precious, fake. She didn't mind as long as they looked good. So it was a kind of luxurious simplicity was, I suppose you'd say, her keynote, both when she did up houses. She did up not only her own house, but the Duke of Westminster's house. And in fact, she did up his house in Scotland. You may be interested to know that she introduced the first bidet to Scotland.
You do find out some wonderful facts in your research.
Yes.
Are you planning a trip to the Riviera whilst you write the book?
Oh, yes, I'm going to the Riviera, and I'm happy to say I've had countless offers of assistance if I wish to go.
Oh, somebody got in there before me, did they?
Yes.
Well, Anne de Courcy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Red. It was a pleasure.
Thanks once again to Anne de Courcy, and she'll be back on a future show telling us the books of her life.
This is an RNIB talking book.
A conversation with narrator Rachel Atkins.
I was a member, I think a lot of people here have been, a member of the Radio Drama Company, which was my rep, really, my theatre rep, because by the time I left drama school, most repertory theatres had shut. And some said, did you ring? I had to ring quite a few times before I was allowed in, but very strict. Professionals only, so obviously I didn't sound that professional. But my most memorable, my best read, I think, for me, the book I really, really enjoyed reading and didn't think I would enjoy reading was a science fiction book called Never Let Me Go by the Japanese writer Ishiguro, who'd wrote Remains of the Day. And it was a brilliant read and something, you know, when you enter into something, you think, oh, I don't want to read this. And it was so beautifully but so simply written. But it was a wonderful read, and I really, really enjoyed that. And then started to read a lot of his other books.
I won't be a carer any more come the end of the year, and though I've got a lot out of it, I have to admit I'll welcome the chance to rest, to stop and think and remember. I'm sure it's at least partly to do with that, to do with preparing for the change of pace, that I've been getting this urge to order all these old memories. What I really wanted, I suppose, was to get straight all the things that happened between me and Tommy and Ruth after we grew up and left Hailsham. But I realise now just how much of what occurred later came out of our time at Hailsham, and that's why I want first to go over these earlier memories quite carefully. Take all this curiosity about Madame, for instance. At one level, it was just us kids larking about. But at another, as you'll see, it was the start of a process that kept growing and growing over the years until it came to dominate our lives.
I got a letter from somebody from the RNIB, I think Isabel Shippey sent it to me, and it was a man who said, normally I hate female readers, but I quite like you, which was quite nice.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally on this Read On special, Robert Kirkwood talks to a voiceover legend who needs no introduction.
Now, a very familiar voice to RNIB Talking Books listeners is Martin Jarvis. How are you today?
Robert, I'm extremely well. I've just been giving the second of two performances, which has been very much tied up with audio as well as theatre and TV and so on, here at the Boswell Festival of Literature, a unique festival because it's very much concerned with biography and autobiography. Of course, I've been talking about Rich McCrompton, the creator of Just William, and P.G. Woodhouse, the creator of Jeeves and Bertie Wooster. And last night we did one story, or I performed one story of William. That was William and the Triplets, a great farce, I think, and the audiences seem to enjoy it. And also Jeeves and the Song of Songs, which is another very funny story, by Woodhouse. And then today I've just been being interviewed about what it's like to do the wacky things that one's been fortunate enough to do, both in the audio world and in radio, and TV and the occasional movie.
Do you remember what your first ever audiobook was?
Do you know, I think it was The Prince and the Pauper, and I knew instinctively that it was not going to be anything I was going to be remembered for, and I came across it somewhere fairly recently, and at the time, I think the publishers who wanted me to record the story hadn't quite understood about the nature of storytelling. I was learning myself from radio the way to communicate a story, but they wanted it told very, very slowly about the prince and so on. And I knew this was not right, because if you were telling a story to your children or bedside story, you wouldn't tell it like that. Even if they were quite young, you wouldn't patronise the ear of the listener, and then the DNA of the story wouldn't be apparent. But, of course, I was obedient to my producers, and I wasn't able to really change that method for them. Soon after that, I was doing all kinds of other things, from Dickens and so on, and I learned more and more about storytelling. And perhaps those early producers learned a bit more too, I don't know.
Now, we have recordings in RNIB that go back 80 years. Have fashions changed in the way you narrate books? I mean, like, do you do a lot of characterization, or do you do a little bit of that? Have things changed along the road?
Things are always changing, Robert. It's a very good question, because there's no final answer to it. I think I would like to say it depends on the author. For instance, if you're doing Dickens, I think you owe it to Charles Dickens to characterise, so that if you were to, say, doing Great Expectations, which I have recorded once or twice, I think you would want to characterise Pip and Miss Havisham and Estella in fairly strong terms. I don't think it would be right for Dickens if you narrated, I'm just making it up, not exact lines, but "Come in, Pip," called Miss Havisham. Estella said, "Yes, boy, come in." I went in and said, "Hello, Miss Havisham." Now, let's say that was the text. I think you're not serving the DNA of the book, because I suspect that Charles Dickens, when he did readings from his own thing, I'm not saying he'd do it like this, but it could be something like, "Come in, Pip," called Miss Havisham. "Yes, come in, boy," said Estella. "Oh, Miss Havisham, I like your house," I said. And somehow I'm telling something about the nature of these three characters. So that would be Dickens. If I was doing a modern thriller, I might consider... I walked into the room. She turned. She said, "Who are you?" I said, "Don't you know?" She said, "I think you're that guy." "That guy who?" I said. She said, "You know." I replied, "No, I don't. I haven't changed my voice at all."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if I did do too much for the lady voice and too much for the guy, I think I might be splitting the text apart more than perhaps the author deserved.
Yeah. So is it a performance just the same as standing on stage, as sitting in a booth?
You're pouring it into the microphone. Everything is poured into that mic, but just as you might with a different performance, pour it into the camera, except in shooting in a film or a TV scene, the one place you don't look is the camera, for obvious reasons. Yeah. But you do look at the mic camera, because everything is down that bottle, if you like, of the mic, because you're thinking of the author and you're thinking how to communicate absolutely at the mic. But the thinking behind all that, what you want to say about the characters, interpret about the characters, serve the writer, serve the situation, that background prep and thinking is not so very different whether you're on the stage or on the film set or in the audio studio.
Obviously, your favourites are among the Woodhouse and the Richmond Crompton books. Is there anything you've narrated that you've hated?
There are very different... It's a very good question, Robert, and you won't be surprised that I'm probably not going to tell you because I have done some audios for different reasons. There is one little thing that's quite good. It's more of an actor's thing, that if something isn't very well written, especially if it's abridged, you do have a little bit more permission to just change something. Mm. Hopefully, as I'm a writer myself, to help to improve that thing or cut that half line or and so on. If it's the book in its entirety, I don't really have that permission, except occasionally an author will say, oh, yes, I didn't think of that. If the author happens to be around, oh, do change that or do cut that adverb. I mean, often you would have, I wonder why he said nervously. So I might want to cut nervously and play it like this. I wonder why, he said, because in telling it aloud, I don't need to tell you that I'm acting it nervously. Mm. I can take that out, but sometimes the author might not want me to do that. But in the end, it's a great achievement to have written a book anyway, written a novel. So I'm likely to want to do it, and also give me sometimes... If I want to try out a character, it may be their author, if it wasn't that written, hadn't really thought what that character would be, just serving the plot in some way. So I might want to think, hey, that character's really a chirpy chappy. Mm. There's nothing against that in the text, or nothing that says it is a chirpy chappy. Mm. but it could go, hello, how are you? Oh, good. I mean, and give it a little colour and a little bit more depth than perhaps there was in that less than well-written book.
I have seen it where the narrator has been three books down a series and a character that's been in all three books in the third book is revealed to have a southern US accent, which was never mentioned before. So, yeah, but anything you have not narrated that you'd love to?
I don't know, really. It's a hard one for me because I've been so fortunate to have narrated many modern books. I've just done what I think is a terrific new novel by a first-time novelist, Nicholas Searle. It's called The Good Liar, and I thoroughly recommend it to RNIB listeners and to anybody who wants to read and hear a great book. It's a very, very good, characterful, surprising, excellently written thriller. So that's The Good Liar, and I did, yes, I did record that. I suppose I could have done some more Trollope, but that's been left to Timothy West, I think, has done a lot of Trollope. Wonderful writer, and I of course would have, if that had come my way and the dates had been right, because you do need time, especially on a Trollope. I mean, Dickens, the full text of David Copperfield, I think they allowed 14 days. It's a big, big book. And I was always quite pleased that I completed it in 10 days. I got on a roll with that, you know. And I have to say that His Royal Highness Prince Charles' birthday party, Roz, my wife, and I were lucky enough to be invited. He'd been listening to my recording of David Copperfield, and he said to me, Martin, I have to tell you, I love your Betsy Trotwood. And I was well pleased.
Now, you're here with your own book about Broadway as well, which you narrate the audio version of course. Give us a slight flavour of that book, because I believe it was meant to be a book about one thing, but then suddenly it became a book about something else.
Yes, I was lucky enough to play Jeeves on Broadway in this extraordinary chamber musical, I think would be a way to describe it. It's called By Jeeves, and it's based on P.G. Woodhouse, to some extent about the Code of the Woosters. I thought, I'll keep a diary. We started it in Pittsburgh in January, and I thought it would be nice. Well, I have to say, I thought it would be nice. Methuen commissioned me to do it, they having published my previous book, which is called Acting Strangely. And so I kept the day-to-day diary about what it would be like for somebody like me, an actor, who wasn't really a singer or a dancer, to be in a musical. And the diary begins like that. I hope it's amusing, and I write about my difficulties at getting my little dance together that you don't know until the end of the evening that when that Jeeves does break out into an incredible dance. And I have my two patter numbers. So that's how the diary goes on, and then we get it better, and it's hopefully quite interesting about how we open and how I'm worrying over it, and Alan Ayckbourn, great director and writer, and Andrew Lloyd Webber comes to rehearsal and says, well, you know, Martin could sing that number. And Alan says, oh, no, I don't think Martin wants to actually sing it. It's much better if it's a patter number. So all that goes on. But then, of course, I say, of course, this is 2001. And 9/11 happens, and so my diary. I felt a bit like I was in charge of some kind of handheld microphone, and I'm recording every day surprising things. And so we're then on Broadway. We achieve Broadway, and the atmosphere is very different. And I'm writing about the aftermath of 9/11 and so on. So it is hopefully an amusing book. I hope it's a book about what it's like to be backstage for something like. By Jeeves, and I called the diary or the book Broadway Jeeves with a question mark. Will we get to Broadway? What will Broadway be like? Jeeves, Broadway Jeeves. So yes, it starts as one thing, a theatrical diary about what it's like, and it becomes, to some extent, I think, a picture of what New York, Manhattan was like at that extraordinary and tragic time.
A short, chubby man holds up a smallish paper parcel and tells me my costume has arrived. I thank him and say I won't have time to look at it until later. He winks, and it's not until we're all gathered round the table that I realise he's playing Sir Watkin Bassett and that it was an actorly joke. I've failed my initial test and demonstrated a temporary irony deficiency. Nerves.
And Martin, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Robert. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
Hey, that's my line. But it'll be business as usual when Read On comes back at the same time next week.